Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio. Tonight we have Steve Sharp. We're going to be talking Australian geckos and lizards. He is the third member of Australian Addiction Reptiles, and we should have a good talk going on about all the different projects that they're working on. Don't forget about, I keep forgetting to say this, Morelia Python Forum, www.moreliapythons.com. That's who the sponsor of the show is. So go over there, check them out. My voice is going in and out. So tonight we have a special guest host. It's Zach Baez from Dark Side Exotics. He's going to be taking my spot after we talk a bit, Owen. But how's it going? What's going on?
What's going on is we are back from the show, you and I, from Hamburg. And it was a fun time. Had by all.
Yeah, it was it was cool. You know, I always kind of question doing shows and if shows are my thing, and you know, it was kind of disappointing when we didn't move anything. You sold the Jag,
right.
And seemed like it was kind of on the slower side for this show, but
the problem is if it's hot and it's a summer weekend and. You know, from what I've been hearing, people were like, is there going to be air? Is there going to be air? Is there going to be air? And the second you say no, but there'll be a fan, nobody wants to be packing into a building. I mean, it's like, that's just kind of sucky. And that's the big selling point of a lot of the indoor shows is we have AC, they don't. And people come to those. The turnout in August is probably going to be worse for Hamburg, just because I know that it is whispered among the vendors that it's dreadful hot. And I also know it's whispered among the people who come to the show that it's also really sucky. So a lot of people in August get in and get out. They run in, grab their rats, and leave.
Oh, okay.
You don't want to be stuck in a hot building.
It seemed like, I guess I shouldn't reveal my secrets and plans and because people might get on board with it, but it seemed like to me that people were looking for things that couldn't be found, and the only thing that they had available were imports in lousy condition by a bunch of different vendors, and it just seemed like an opportunity to, you know, just even talking pythons as captive bred pythons. I mean, it seems like a no-brainer because, you know, there wasn't a whole lot available except for, you know, the ball pythons. But if you were looking for, I mean, even chondros, that was a big thing. A lot of people came up to the table and looking for just locality-type animals, and there was none to be found. So it was kind of a shame for them. But I'll tell you what did
catch
my... There was
one person who came up...
What's that?
There was one person who came up and said, "Do you guys have cane toads?" And I'm like, what? Why would you want that?
Yeah, I do remember
those
that.
Those things are horrible.
Yeah. And the funny thing was is that there was one right behind us, right?
Yeah, that was true. Yeah.
Yeah. So. I did catch an eye at a cool snake that caught my eye, and you know I was enamored by them during the whole show was Honduran milk snakes.
We're next to a Honduran milk snake guy, and you're over there more often than you're over with me at the table. These things are awesome. Like, yeah, I've had those before.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. So.
Guy's name was
you were
Ken
all about, man.
Yeah, Ken Markle. Really cool guy. He had just a few king snakes there, and more milk snakes, and it was cool stuff. But, you know, I guess in the news, the big thing was I wish I could have went to it, but because of work reasons, the Northwest Carpet Fest. They raised $2,300 for Rico, which
wow.
totaled a total $7,000.
Nice. Oh,
right?
My God, that's awesome.
So,
yeah.
So that took us to almost shy of 10 grand. So
that's awesome.
I don't know
Fantastic.
If you saw the picture, but Nick Mutton, he...
ate a rat.
He ate a rat for $75.
He ate a rat.
Yeah.
Had I known... that we could pay Nick Mutton to eat anything, I would have started sending him money years ago.
Yeah.
Also, I would like to say that at the Arboreal Symposium, we need to figure something else out for him to eat. So, somebody start thinking.
So, speaking of that, that's coming up. Don't forget about that. August 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. You can go over and check out www.arborealsymposium.com. For more information and details, but looks like there's going to be, it looks like it's a 50-50 mix of carpet and chondro guys. So
I think there's one poison dart frog, dude. So it's like, oh, all right.
Poison dart frogs are boreal?
I am. Maybe he does other things, too, which, okay, whatever.
Hey, man, the more the merrier. So, you know,
exactly.
Whatever.
It's fine.
Yeah.
So, I guess other things I've seen in the news is Paul Harrison posted something up today, or like 5 minutes ago, or something that he got a white albino coming out of the egg or something like that. I have no idea what the hell that is.
Oh yeah, I did see that.
Yeah.
Did you see that orange?
Crazy thing? What?
I don't know what to call it.
Yeah.
But it was...
Everybody was pointing out at the show, like, it's crazy. I don't know.
I posted it over on the Morelia Python Radio Facebook page for you to check out.
Yes,
but,
you did.
Yeah, you can go take a peek at it, but definitely...
All the insane things coming around carpet pythons. It's ridiculous. I love it. So...
Yeah, there was a lot of people at the show that they kept talking about how they were aggressive and, you know, and it was pretty cool that we actually took some out of the cage and, you know, got to show people that they weren't. And, you know, we were holding, you know, my stock, your stock. You know, they were chill and people were kind of like, you know, surprised at that. So, you know,
yeah.
At least that was a good
thing. Well, I always like to bring. As I always like to bring the ones that are chill. I mean, like, and the other great news over the weekend is that I procured another mutt and for craziness.
Yeah.
It's entirely your fault.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I got a cool caramel tiger on her, man. She is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Got to get her on the picture block. Pretty soon.
Yeah, you do. You show off my babies. I gotta get him up to size. He's like, all right, you need to come because we gotta get you ready. So
cool stuff. Let's see. I don't know if I have anything else. You got eggs hatching out yet? Or what the hell are you doing over there, man?
What? I'm not doing anything. What are you doing?
I don't know. I hear a whole bunch of noise, like somebody's moving.
I thought you were like rummaging through a drawer.
Who is that?
I am literally sitting down.
Oh. I guess somebody's...
Did you not mute everybody? Christ.
No,
anyway.
Everybody's muted. I don't know. It's kind of weird. Anyway.
Very rude. Anyway.
Yeah.
I was like,
okay.
What the fuck is he doing? Anyway. I do not have... I have one egg hatching right now, and that's from Sophie's Clutch.
It's hatching.
The jet. It's hatching. Yeah. It's a normal.
There you go.
45 slugs out of a Jag clutch, and I got a normal baby.
Wow.
So we'll see what happens. It's poking its head out now, but I got tigers coming soon, and the mangrove monitor eggs are starting to dent. So I got yelled at today that I don't take enough pictures of the eggs. So I guess I'm going to have to start taking pictures of monitor eggs. So.
Yeah. We were watching a show yesterday with Steve Irwin with those monitors, and they were pretty cool, man. It wasn't what I thought it was, and they stay relatively on the smaller side. Well, they're not like water monitor size.
Yeah, I mean, well, the monitors Irwin was around with, those are Australian mangrove monitors. These are of the same kind of species, but it's like different localities. They jump around the islands like chondros do. But they are the relatively the same size though.
Okay.
But you know, there's scale number on the head and spot pattern differences and crap that, you know, I look at it and say it's a mangrove monitor, where then I'm told I'm wrong. So this mangrove monitor. All right.
Just when you think you know all there is to know about reptiles, there's another group of some type of reptiles that you know nothing about.
And you're
that's what I
always
feel like.
Completely an idiot. Yeah. You have no idea what's going on. But other thing, I guess, before we bring everybody on, there's one more thing. That there was some kind of a story that a Reptile Report and Urban Jungle Radio and a few other people reported on, of a female snapping turtle coming up on a golf course to lay some eggs. And I guess somebody took a golf club to her because it was a snapping turtle and it was there. And that's just kind of sickening. And
wow.
Yeah, I hate that kind of crap.
What the hell's wrong
with
you?
I have no idea. Because, you know, I don't know, when I was a kid, I was told if you see an animal, it's cool to look at, but don't go anywhere near it. Definitely don't hurt it just for being there. They couldn't find any eggs at the scene, so they don't know what happened to them. But she probably has some spinal injuries, facial injuries, and her shell's cracked as shit. And there was no reason for any of that to happen. It's almost like I went to a firehouse to get a copperhead, and it turned out to be a northern water snake. And when I told them that they should just let it go outside, they looked at me like I just suggested to shoot a baby. It's leave them the frick alone. They're in their natural habitat. Just because we're here and they're here doesn't mean that they have to die. So they're offering $1,000 reward for any information about what happened to the turtle. If you do have information, please call the number that's associated with it. And people should never, ever just feel the need to cave in an animal's skull because it's sitting there.
That's crazy. Yeah, the one other thing that I saw in the news that was actually on the news was there was a guy, I can't remember his name, but he stole a bunch of ball pythons and he went to Hamburg and tried to sell them and he got caught and
holy shit! That's awesome.
$10,000 worth of ball pythons or something like that. So
wow,
crazy stuff.
Did he try selling them back to the guy he stole them from?
No, I don't think the guy that he sold them from was there. I think he just came into the show and tried to sell them to different breeders, I guess. But I'm assuming that whatever it was, we just lost Steve. Whatever it was, whatever it was, they knew what it was, You know what I mean? They knew that somebody was missing these snakes. So
something distinct enough that, or I imagine, if somebody stole my snakes, I'd have pictures all over the place. And
right.
If they showed up in an ad or on something, I was hoping some carpet python person would alert me. So.
Yeah. So. All right. Well, let's bring him on first, Zach. Hey, Zach. Welcome to the show. And you're going to take over for me. And
Eric is dying. Yeah.
That's Frank Steve. Hey, Steve, welcome to Morelia Python Radio. Glad to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
How you doing, Steve?
All right, guys.
How are you guys?
Sweet. So we now have, like, a complete trio of all of Australian Edition, which is, like, fantastic. So
yeah, we collected,
like,
the
whole set. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah,
so,
I'm happy to be on the show, guys. It's I've listened to you guys several times, and I guess you guys have never really had a topic that is up my alley, so this is will be nice.
So we had to bring you on so you could talk about stuff that's up your alley. So,
yep.
So anyway, let's just jump right into it. And Steve, can you tell us what got you into reptiles?
Yeah, sure. I'm probably like a lot of you guys, where I grew up just catching garter snakes and horned lizards in the vacant lot next to my house. And I was lucky to grow up in some herp-rich habitats like northwestern Arizona and in New Mexico. I lived in New Mexico for a few years when I was really young, and just grew up chasing anything that moved out in the desert.
Wow.
And then I had some parents that were really cool and really laid back about me having animals in the house. So I would bring things home and keep odds and ends of wild-caught herps. And eventually that blossomed into wanting to keep exotics. And I think around the time I was 10 or 11, I got my first pair of leopard geckos. And by the next year, I had a pretty large colony of leopard geckos and bearded dragons, and I think I had around 300 leopard geckos by that next year, and
wow.
was breeding them, and my parents were really supportive of me growing up, and kind of just supported that, and it kind of snowballed from there. I'd always been interested in Australian reptiles and seen them in books and things like that, but could never really afford them as a kid. I was producing a lot of leopard geckos and things, it just wasn't something that I could really afford until I was more of an adult. And, as I grew in the hobby, my collection grew, and here we are today. I'm part of Australian Addiction, and that's, I guess, kind of how I got started. I guess I've always just been interested in reptiles and into reptiles.
That's cool. So what gravitated you towards lizards and geckos as opposed to, like, I don't know, boa constrictor? Yeah.
When I was younger, I think it was my mom had one rule, and that was that I couldn't have snakes in the house when I was a younger kid. But that eventually changed. My dad was kind of a big kid at heart, so he would take me to the herp shows, and one of the shows we went to, he bought me a pair of snakes. It was a pair of Kenyan sand boas. And we didn't tell my mom about it until we got home. and then those were my first snakes. I think I was 12, around there, 12 or so. And then from there on, I started keeping things like I've kept a few carpets, like jungle carpets, and odds and ends of colubrids, different milk snakes, and things like that. I think that was the main thing that gravitated me toward lizards. But then when I started to keep lizards, I just saw how much personality they have and how interactive they are. There's just something about a lizard, some species, you go in and you open the enclosure and they're just there looking at you, and you can tell that they're looking back at you and that they're wanting something. Or I have a few lizards that would come out and actually eat out of my hands, things like that.
Well, that's cool. So
they're just more interactive, I guess, for me than some of the snakes. And on the behavioral side of things, not that snakes don't do interesting things or interesting behaviors, but on the behavioral side of things, lizards do a whole slew of really cool behaviors, which are a lot of fun to watch. And I guess that's what kind of draws me to lizards, is they're a little bit more interactive than snakes.
That's cool. So what got you hooked up with Ben and Justin over in Australian Addiction? Did they just kind of, like, find you?
it was kind of funny. I started emailing Justin just because I really liked his website. I liked a lot of the species he kept. I had very similar interests, to what they had going. And we became kind of email pen pals in a way. We would email each other back and forth without having ever met each other in person. And then one of the NARBC shows, I think it was in 2008 in Anaheim, I actually sent him an email and it's like, hey, we're going to come out there. Is it cool if I stop by your booth? And we met in person. And then my parents actually lived in Utah for a little bit, pretty close by where Justin was. And so it became a thing where when I would go up to visit my parents, I would go up and visit Justin. And, over time, one day I was asking some advice to Justin. I was like, I'm getting ready to start my own business. What do you think of these names? And he's like, why don't you just call it Australian Addiction and become part of us? So that's kind of how that whole thing kind of meshed together. And it just made sense because I primarily work with lizards, and Ben and Justin primarily work with pythons. So, it just made perfect sense to kind of complement one another, and our collections really do mesh really well together and complement each other really well. So.
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Why not use each other's strengths? Yeah. I like that idea.
Yeah, definitely. It's a lot easier. I mean, we get to offer a wider variety of animals without having to break our backs to keep that many animals on hand. Because, like Justin and Ben both have pretty demanding jobs. They're both PhDs and do all kinds of cool research and cool science-y stuff. And I'm a full-time student, and they're both kind of harping on me and pushing me towards that, toward doing a PhD as well. So that might be something that I do down the road here when I finish my undergraduate degree.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. Wow. So specifically, what drew you to knobtails? And can you kind of break them down for us? You know, because it can be kind of complicated, in terms of how many species there are, subspecies, how there's more of a smooth variety, there's more of a rough variety, the differences between them, that sort of thing.
All right. Yeah, no problem. I think the first thing that really drew me to knobtails was that issues of Reptiles magazine. I don't know if you guys remember that, but for me, it was kind of a landmark issue because it was the first issue of Reptiles magazine that I ever found, that I ever owned, was the actual Australian knobtail gecko issue. It was May 1996, and it had that article by Casey Lazick and Ernie Wagner in it. I don't know if you guys remember that issue or not, but it was one of my favorites. Yeah, it's probably in somebody's stack of old Reptiles magazines at home. But, if you have it, I suggest getting it out and dusting it off and taking a look at it because it's really great. And Ernie Wagner and Casey Lazick really were kind of the forefront guys out there as far as nephrous care and husbandry goes. A lot has changed since that article came out as far as taxonomy goes. But kind of what Zach was touching on with the rough and the smooth, nephrous are kind of broken into two different categories. There's rough and then there's smooth. And then even I would say there's a third category, which is smooth thin-tailed knobtails. So there's the Levis complex, which is comprised of nephrous levis, which is your garden variety smooth knobtail gecko. That's probably one of the more common knobtail geckos that we have in the hobby here in the U.S. And there's two subspecies of nephrous levis. There's Levis ossiandentalis, which comes from the coastal region of Western Australia, and Levis pilbarensis, which comes from the Pilbara region of Western Australia. And they all look really similar. If you're if you're, I've had a few friends that have put up pictures of actual wild caught Levis and Ossian dentalis and filbrensis and asked people to tell what the species was, and people couldn't get it right. I mean, you really have no idea unless you know exactly what the scale counts are and, you know, you're actually have the gecko in hand. There's no way you can tell from a picture with the, wow, especially with wild ones, because they're so variable. Those guys have a big, fat, broad tail, and then the rest of the smooth nephurus have a thin tail. And so that's where you have Nephurus stellatus, which is the starred knob-tailed gecko. Those guys come from South Australia, and then there's a population in Western Australia. And then Nephurus delmine, which comes from South Australia. And then you have Levisimus, Nephurus levisimus, which has a pretty widespread range in Western Australia, and then they're in part of like the Northern Territory. The range goes over there a little bit. Nephurus vertebralis, which is the midlined knob-tailed gecko. Those guys look a lot like Levis, but they have this bright yellow stripe down the middle of their back. So they're pretty interesting. And then they have the thin tail as well.
Cool.
But a lot of people just refer to the vertebralis as skinny Levis. I mean, that's kind of what they look like, a skinny version of Levis levis. And then you get over into the rough species, which you have your Wheeleri, which is what Zach keeps.
Yep.
You have Wheeleri cinctus, which is the one that we have here available in the U.S. Very common, very prolific in the pet trade in the U.S. now, and that's the banded knob-tailed gecko. So those guys have the bands across their back, and then there's another population of Wheeleri, which is the nominate form, which is Wheeleri. Those guys are pretty rare outside of Australia. There's some in Europe, but other than that, there's not a whole lot outside of Australia. So just really, really interesting. Those guys come from Western Australia, and just a really cool gecko with lots of really interesting behaviors we can talk about a little bit later on. But and then lastly, we have the Asper complex, at one point, Nephurus amii, which is the more common of the rough knob-tails that you'll see in the pet trade besides Wheeleri, amii are the ones that get big, and they're the heaviest bodied gecko from mainland Australia. Some of the big adult females can push up to 80, 85 grams. So some of my big females will actually eat like small mice in between clutches. So they're impressive geckos. One of my favorite species. But at one point, they were all classified as one species, but there's three distinct populations. Amii comes from the Centralian region in the center of the continent, right there where Ayers Rock is. There's Asper, which comes from Queensland, and that goes all the way up the Cape York Peninsula. Their population goes all the way up the Cape York Peninsula. And then there is also Shea'i, which comes from part of the Northern Territory and part of the top half of Western Australia. Those were divided, I want to say it was in like 97 or so, right around the time that article came out in Reptiles, which if you go and look at that article, it does refer to amii as Asper, which might be confusing for some people, but that's Nephurus amii in that article.
Wow.
That's kind of the genus as a whole. Sometimes people include Underwoodosaurus mealei, which is the Australian barking gecko or thick-tailed gecko. There's two more species of Underwoodosaurus, but with recent taxonomic changes, Spirus, Underwoodosaurus spirus, has actually been separated out, and it's in its own genus now. The granite belt thick-tailed gecko. Those guys come from down in the southern part of on the coast, on the eastern coast. I want to say it's like down in like the New South Wales area, maybe a little bit of Queensland area, but I think more New South Wales on the eastern coast. They're a little bit cooler species. They're found at higher elevations. But their new genus is Uvicidicolis. Uvicidicolis is how you say it.
That's not hard.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird weird genus name, but it's like it just means like moisture loving, I guess, from the naming. But so that guy's its own genus now, and then they've known about this population of muli that's in the Pilbara region for a long time, but someone finally went and actually looked at it and, you know, did scale counts on it, compared it to other muli populations, and it's a separate, distinct species. So that one's Underwoodosaurus cirrhosis. So that one's a completely new species, and then you'll run into people that still lump the Underwoodosaurus genus in with the Nephrurus genus. But they're the most recent taxonomic work that's been done on them actually places them in their own genus.
Huh.
So that's kind of Nephrurus taxonomy in a nutshell, I guess.
Yeah, it's ever evolving, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, well, of course, ever evolving. They found a population that they knew about, and then someone actually looked at it.
Yeah.
And
that was
something completely different. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They knew it was there, and they just kind of assumed, oh yeah, it's just muli. But it's completely isolated. Like if you look at a range map, there's no muli for hundreds of miles. You know, it's completely isolated. And it was kind of funny, Justin and I were looking at a field herp forum a couple of years back. He emailed me these pictures, and he's like, look at this muli. And I was like, dude, that has to be a different species. You know, that it looks completely different from any muli that you look at. I mean, anybody that looks at it wouldn't even think that it was a muli. I mean, it looks completely different. And so they finally did some taxonomy work on it, and yeah, sure enough, it's very distinct from the other muli. So
that's hilarious.
Cool, yeah. I mean, I don't think I could ever be a taxonomist. It would just be frustrating to me to constantly go in and revise all this stuff all the time. I think I'd just pull my hair out.
Wow.
Yeah, I think so too.
So the difference between the rough species and the smooth species, how does that pertain to the environments they live in and pretty much the ecology of it, you know?
Okay.
Like, why is some smooth, why is some rough? That's where they are.
Okay, yeah, no, that's a great question. It's kind of funny. I mean, most of the smooth species tend to be more of sand dune specialists. They live in areas where there's lots of sand dunes and spinifex grass, clumps, and what they actually do is they'll burrow down into the root systems of the spinifex, and they'll live in those in that moist environment underneath there, and that's how they get hydration in those really, really arid conditions. So they'll actually go in and they'll actually plug the front of that burrow. They'll kick some moist sand into that burrow, and they'll just make themselves a little capsule there under the ground, and when they're hungry again, they dig out and they go look for food. So that's kind of the smooth species. They're more of a burrowing species, and the rough species tend to live in areas that are more rocky. So you're looking at big boulder piles, cap rocks and rock crevices, and those guys will actually just wedge themselves deep down. And in captivity, the only time I ever see my rough species digging is when they're nesting. So that's the only time I've ever really seen them dig. In the wild, we don't know really a ton about their natural history as far as what they do under the rocks. They might have burrows under there. But as far as what I've done, I've actually provided opportunities for them to dig, and they don't really dig unless they're getting ready to lay eggs. I mean, I don't see them tunnel or anything. I've done it just to see what they would do, and they just kind of ignored it. So I just give them a kind of more shallow, more arid setup. And then the smooth species, I kind of do a little bit, you know, like a high pile of dirt on one end of the enclosure that's moistened, and then they'll dig their burrows into that. But that's kind of, I guess, the main differences between the smooth and the rough is kind of where they're found. And you know, it's kind of interesting that some of the species like Asper and Shea-eye, they inhabit these forests that are monsoonal. So they're seasonally dry.
Wow.
So for big stretches of the year, they're completely dry, bone dry, and then they have these huge wet seasons. So I think that I've been experimenting with misting and different things like that, and it seems to work pretty well with keeping those guys a little bit more happy, I think, as far as, you know, giving them a little bit of a more cool dry season and then, you know, giving them a more wet spring. Not that it's necessary to breed them or anything like that, but they'll breed fine without it. But it's just kind of, I just kind of mess around with it just to kind of see what will happen and if it changes any behaviors or anything like that.
Right. Now, well,
that's cool.
The cage setups, are you keeping these guys in rats? Are you keeping them in cages? And kind of like, what are your temps going for, substrate, that sort of thing? How do you water them? How do you give them water? And how are you feeding them?
Okay, great question, Zach. Basically, the easiest thing to keep them in, especially if you're going to be breeding them and keeping any
mm-hmm.
numbers of Nephuras, the best thing I recommend is keeping them in rack systems. And then I would even go a step further and say closed-sided rack systems. They seem to provide a little bit more security than an open-sided, like say, like a vision rack that
mm-hmm.
has open sides, or maybe even some
right.
of the animal plastics, like the Economy line of animal plastics that has those open sides. I would
mm-hmm.
say like a closed-sided, what I keep mine in is I keep them in animal plastics racks. They're completely closed-sided, and the size that I keep most of my smaller species of Nephuris in is like a 15-quart tub. So like the,
mm-hmm.
the men's shoebox size, I guess, is what you'd call it.
Right.
So that's about the size that you'd want for an adult. Babies can be kept just fine in a shoebox size enclosure. And,
mm-hmm.
yeah, just very, very easy care. So as far as, like, a temperature gradient, you do want to provide a temp gradient. So you want a warm end and a cool end. And you want the ambient air temp or the ground temp to be in the upper 80s on the warm end. So 88, 89, right around there. And on the cool
mm-hmm.
end, you want that to be down into the mid to low 70s. I try to keep my reptile room in around 75 during the summer, which is not easy in Arizona in the Phoenix area because it's the high today was like 110 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hot here and it's definitely a chore to keep it in that range. Some of you guys who have basements and things like that, it's a little bit easier to keep that low temp on the cool end. And then a basic setup would be two hides, one on the cool end, one on the warm end. For the smooth species, a big pile of sand on the cool end. I do about a 5 to 6 inch depth of sand on the cool end, and then I moisten that and cover it with a hide box and actually push that hide box down into the sand so they kind of have something that's concrete that they can, you know, have an edge against, you know, when they go under the hide.
Right.
And then, the warmer species, or the rough species would just be like about, not even an inch of substrate, almost an inch of substrate. And then again, just two hide boxes, one on the cool ends, one on the warm ends, and just very basic setup. It works really well for them. They don't need elaborate setups. I've had some customers send me pictures of some really nice, naturalistic desert terrariums that they set up for their Nephuris that they bought for me, and you know, by all means do that if that's what you want to do. I mean, it looks beautiful, it's a cool display, but you probably won't see them very often, you know. So I think the rack system, if you're going to breed them, is by far the best thing to do. But say if you're just keeping one single Nephuris, I'd say a 10 gallon aquarium would work perfect with a screen top. Again, you just need to make sure that your temps are good and that you're able to maintain those proper temps and that type of a setup with that much
right.
air circulation going through it. And then I guess as far as food and water goes, I feed crickets as a staple, but you can also feed dubia as a staple. It seems to work better if you want to feed dubia to start them out on dubia right out of the egg. As opposed
mm-hmm.
to starting them out on crickets, because they do have a preference for crickets. I've seen, especially the smooth species, it seems to have to do with how visual of a predator that they are. They're very focused on their prey, and you know they chase those prey items down and pounce on them. And I think that the dubia just don't move enough for most of the smooth species in the forest. Yeah, I mean, they'll burrow under the edge of the hide boxes, and they'll burrow under the sand, and you're like, oh, good, that one ate. And then a week later, you're cleaning poop out, and you sift up all these dubia, and it's like, oh, man. So, you know, the crickets are, when they're gone out of the enclosure, they're eating, you know. So that's kind of why I primarily feed crickets as a staple. They're a little bit easier to keep track of. And then I do supplement with dubia, waxworms, they'll eat anything. I mean, in the wild, they predominantly eat spiders, centipedes, scorpions. Even eat other geckos. Is a big portion of their diet in the wild. When these guys are active at night, they're like the second shift of geckos. So they're the later shift of geckos that kind of, they're more active around 10 p.m. or later, as opposed to some of the smaller species of gecko that come out right at dusk. So these guys are kind of the second night shift. So what they're eating is going to be spiders and scorpions, other predatory insects. So it's kind of interesting. I haven't really experimented too much with feeding them any centipedes or spiders or anything like that. But there's a few species that. What was that?
I said that'd be kind of interesting to try out.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean,
oh my god.
That we're going to work on down the road is doing a food preference study. That's something Justin and I are working on together, and I just need to find the time to do it. I've just been so busy with school and work and family that there's not a lot of time left over for anything other than cleaning and feeding the geckos. So, you know, once I find a little bit more time, we're going to do something like that and use some of the native insects here to kind of see what happens as far as if there is a prey preference there. And because if you look at the stomach content analysis of a lot of these species, they're predominantly eating predatory insects or predatory arachnids. They're eating spiders. They're eating centipedes and scorpions. Those are the primary stomach contents of a lot of these geckos. And the thing that's weird is there's tons of other insect species that are active and live in their areas that are active at night. So that's kind of the questions that we're wanting to answer. You know, why are they only eating the spiders and the scorpions, you know, if there's all these other prey items available to them?
Interesting.
Right.
Could it be almost like how the horned lizards kind of only eat the ants type of thing, where they have a specific preference, and maybe we're missing something on their diet that maybe would help? Although it seems like they breed like crazy anyway in captivity. Mm-hmm. It would be kind of cool to see that happen. And I could totally see like my gecko take out a centipede, man. He doesn't play around.
Definitely.
Oh man, they're like little bulldogs. Definitely. Man. They don't play.
There's the BBC website and you type in knob-tailed gecko, it will pull up a video, and it's a levis, and it's inside a termite mound, and it shows it eat a centipede that's longer than its body. It's pretty amazing.
Whoa.
How it takes everything out. So yeah, so check that out. It's just like on the BBC website. I think it's like BBC Nature, and then if you type in knob-tailed gecko, it'll pull it up. It's the first video that pops up.
Check that
out. It's a really cool video. So
wow,
that's kind of cool.
Badass.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess the last thing to tie together would be water. They're really easy to water. They don't need a water dish. Actually, there's some people that put water dishes in the enclosure. I've experimented with it just to kind of play devil's advocate and see if it works or not. In my opinion, they don't use it. It just is something for crickets to fall in and drown, or for they just kick sand into it. You know, it's just a mess, and they don't really need it. So what I do is I just mist the enclosures a couple of times a week during the warm part of the year, and in the winter, maybe once every other week, I'll mist the enclosures, just watching them and making sure they're not getting too dehydrated. And, you know, at those lower temperatures, they seem to retain everything a little bit better with as far as food and water goes.
Right.
So, yeah, water is easy. You just spray them with a sprayer, like a bug, one of the bug sprayers, plant and garden sprayers, or a squirt bottle. I prefer the garden sprayers because they're, you know, I have so many that I have to mist all at once. But if you just have a couple, just a little hand squirt bottle will work perfect. And you just zap them with the squirt bottle. I usually do it early in the evening when they're out and active, just so if they're outside their hide boxes, I can actually miss them and make sure that they're actually getting some water. But a lot of times you'll just see them run up to the side of the enclosure and just start licking the drops as they're as they're stuck to the side of the enclosure.
That's cool.
Yeah. Now, I have to ask you.
Oh, my God, I found the video. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. But I
I'm sorry. That was, I'm sorry. I'm going to post this on Morelia Python Radio Facebook page. Holy crap. Sorry.
Isn't that cool? I mean,
that was insane.
Huge.
that was a cherry centipede, too. Those things are vicious. All right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Continue, Zach.
Big centipede.
Yeah. So if I didn't ask you this, somebody would kill me because he would probably ask me about five times to ask you this question. Supplementation is huge with lizards, right? Huge with geckos.
Uh-huh.
What is your supplementation regime? Can you kind of tell us what you're doing with that? Because calcium ratios to D3 to vitamins for a lot of snake people is too much to handle. You know what I mean? It's you know, they can't comprehend it. So is there any way you could break it down for us, you know, nice and easy?
Yeah,
and,
yeah, not a problem. I mean, supplementation is kind of it's a really necessary part of any lizard husbandry that you do. Pretty much all species are going to require a good amount of supplementation. Maybe the only ones I would say maybe would be monitors that you don't have to supplement as hard, but that depends on who you talk to. You know, that's all opinion. And supplementing monitors' food isn't going to hurt them at all. But with the nephritis, I mean, what I found works really the best is kind of what the majority of people who use supplementation is mineral indoor, so mineral eye. For a calcium as the primary calcium, and then the Reptical, I'm sorry, Herptivite by Reptical. So like the Herptivite multivitamin, and so kind of what I do is I feed every single feeding with a dusting of mineral eye, and then especially females that are breeding, I make sure and coat those crickets or roaches or even sometimes I'll dunk a live pinky mouse or a live mouse in some mineral before I throw it in the enclosure. And then the Herptivite I use, maybe I use that once every fifth feeding. So it's just kind of something to boost those multivitamins. You don't need to do that as often. But that's kind of the regime that I follow, and it's worked really well for me as far as raising up generations of hatchlings and reproducing females. Sometimes I'll rotate my calcium supplement. I'll just get like a pure calcium carbonate supplement, like maybe the one that ZooMed puts out, like just an all-purpose calcium and indoor formula.
Gotcha.
And just rotate that through every once in a while with the breeding females. That seems to help. Some females seem to not absorb calcium as well as others, so sometimes it helps to just kind of switch it up and get something different in there, and that seems to really help those females that have problems rebounding after laying clutches of eggs. Another little trick that you might follow if you're breeding your animals really heavily is putting a small dish of calcium inside the enclosure for the females to lick from. Observed females going over and actually licking the calcium. So you'll hear leopard gecko breeders doing this, or maybe even some crested gecko people doing this, where they'll put like a little dish of calcium inside the enclosure. And those females, I mean, they're engineered to search that stuff out. You know, that's years and years of evolution has, you know, taught them to, this is something that is needed for me to make eggs. I'm making eggs. So there it is right there. So they'll go and they'll actually lick that stuff up. So
it's funny. Cause you know, when I heard that geckos do that, it reminded me of a story. Because I've heard that leopard geckos do that. When I had mine, she would do that. And I heard a story that, you know, if you have a kid, you know, a lot of they tell teachers all the time, you see kids eating chalk, or if you see kids eating like glue and stuff, they're actually are missing calcium in their diet, and they're trying to make up for it just by, you know, instinct. They know that is made out of calcium, and they need to eat it. It's kind of, I always found that really fascinating, and it's really cool that the geckos also know, you know, that they
Oh yeah,
know what they're doing. You know.
I think it's so interesting, like that whole olfactory aspect of even humans. I mean, what you brought up is like we don't really know how we know that we need those minerals, but we know we need them. You know, and it's something to do with our olfactory system, something that we don't understand 100%. You know, but we know we need those minerals in our bodies. Same thing with the geckos, with any animal. Is if there's something lacking in their diet or they're deficient, that, you know, their physiology will demand that they get that into their system somehow. So that's why you see kind of random stuff sometimes, like turtles eating rocks and, you know, like all kinds of weird stuff. You know, I've heard of monitors eating the rocks in their enclosure or eating pieces of bark. And, you know, maybe sometimes those are accidental ingestions, but I think sometimes they really search those things out to try and supplement something in their diet that's missing.
Right. Huh. Okay, cool. So I tried, have you ever seen the Calcium Plus that potassium puts out? It's kind of like the all-in-one type of, would you suggest something like that just for people who don't really?
Yeah, definitely. Like Alan's done some really amazing work with all of his calcium supplements and all the food products that he puts out. I mean, he's done some amazing research into all aspects of the physiology of the animal and, you know, balancing phosphorus ratios and things like that. And, he's done some great stuff. So, I mean, anything Alan puts out is great. And I've actually used the Calcium Plus I used it kind of this past season. And then I've gone back to my Mineral and Herptivite. I kind of used it as my off or new calcium rotation this past season. And I had really good results with it. It really seems to add a little bit of color even to some of the animals. So I would suggest that. It's a good, easy thing to use, especially for someone that's maybe not as familiar with supplementing, because it's easy. You can feed it every feeding. You don't have to measure anything. I mean, you don't have to worry about, did I feed the Herptivite on the fifth feeding or not? You know, you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. You can feed it every single time without any issues. I would definitely recommend anything by Rep Ashi, and that Calcium Plus would work great for the Nephoris.
I use that just because, I want to make it as easy as possible. So
yeah.
I raised my little guy on that, and, he's been rocking it, and it worked out great. Actually, I use that supplement on everything. The skin, everybody gets it. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't realize when you go to, like, Petco or PetSmart, they have it there. It's under the T-Rex kind of label, and they'll have it like Calcium Plus, the leopard geckos, Calcium Plus, the bearded dragon. Believe it or not, it's all the same thing. They just market it towards different people just to make sales, but it's all the same. So, you know, I use the leopard gecko one, and I just, you know, I have a little thing of it, and have everybody gets it, and it works out great. So,
awesome.
There's a lot of alternatives out there, especially, I mean, Rapashi does some amazing stuff, right? And it's funny you say that about the pigment. I wonder if you put any of that that pigment enhancer that he has. I wonder if you put any of that, those beta carotenes and all that.
Uh-huh.
I'd be kind of interested to know. I guess I should probably look that up. I'm sure I could find you on the site. Maybe that's why we're getting better color out of them.
For sure. Yeah. Before I actually purchased it, I did a lot of research. I've met Alan several times just at different herb shows and things, and he's a great guy to talk to and stuff. And I wanted to find out a little bit more because I was looking for something to kind of rotate my current supplement off of. And he has a big write-up on his website about the Calcium Plus and kind of how he balanced it out and how he kind of troubleshot the initial formula to where it is now. And it's a great read if you're interested in it, if you're interested in physiology at all. I mean, it's got a lot of in-depth stuff and different measurements and things that he put into this formula, but it seems like it's a great supplement, and I've used it with successful results. So,
cool.
And I agree, the beta-carotene and different things that are found in it, it does seem to really improve the coloration of the geckos, especially it seems like the levis. It makes them a little bit more red. It makes that red pop a little bit more. If you guys are listening and you keep Nephoris, maybe try that Calcium Plus and see if it improves your animal's colors.
That's cool. Yeah. You can alter the colors that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's kind of funny. Like, there's things called carotenoids that are found in a lot of different seeds and fruits and vegetables, and there's some species of birds that actually, if they don't get the carotenoids in their diet, they'll be like bright yellow. But if they get the carotenoids in their diet, the males will be bright red. So I mean, it's kind of one of those things,
right,
that, you know, before we were able to really look at physiology and what these animals were eating, they were separate species. You know, there's yellows,
mm-hmm,
and there's reds, and they're different, you know, but they're actually the same species. They just get different food in different parts of their ranges. So
that's
even
awesome.
Different parts of the year, you know, so the same animal could be yellow one year and red the next year if it got into some seeds that had the carotenoids in it.
Gotcha. Now, how are you going about breeding? Are you dropping them down cool? Are you just,
mm-hmm,
letting it just ride with the temperatures as it happened in your house? And are some species more difficult to breed than others? And
okay,
how do you set up nest boxes, you know, just the general stuff?
Okay. Yeah, no problem. With breeding, you know, there's really mixed feelings about cooling with Nephurus. And I'll tell you right now, it's not 100% necessary to breed Nephurus to cool them. You know, I recommend doing it because it's more healthy for the animals. But in nature, they've actually collected females pretty much every month out of the year when they were able to find them, and they've had eggs in their stomachs. I mean, you know, eggs at all different,
wow,
stages of development. So, I mean, they breed all throughout the year, and they store sperm. So they can actually store sperm for really long periods of time. Some people have reported 8 months, even sometimes longer than that, where they're getting females that haven't bred to a male, and their female is still laying fertile eggs. You know, a lot of times,
wow,
what will happen is I'll have geckos come out of cooling, and they'll cycle a little bit different than they normally do, and I'll be like, oh, yeah, she's gravid. So they'll come out of cooling and they'll become gravid right when that ovulation happens, and it's because they had sperm stored from the previous year's breeding season. And so that's
crazy.
Kind of something that's really cool about these guys and really interesting is that it's not necessarily necessary to cool them, but I recommend doing it because it gives the females a break. You're going to get healthier females, you're going to get healthier hatchlings, you're going to get a higher hatch rate, and you're going to get more eggs if you do a cooling period. Some of the breeders in Australia don't cycle their animals. They don't cool their animals at all. Kind of how you get them to stop laying eggs is you just stop feeding them or slow down the amount of food you're feeding them. And that can be kind of dangerous sometimes, especially if you get a female that's ovulating and you're not aware of it and you slow down what she's eating, she's going to keep developing those eggs. That could cause a lot of issues for the female, possibly even kill the female. Because
right,
she'll invest every last ounce of energy into developing those eggs, you know. So even take calcium from her bones and, you know, that can cause,
mm-hmm,
a lot of different issues, you know, for that female. So cooling them is basically what I do is I kind of just gradually drop the temperature on the warm end of the enclosure. And I do that in the cold part of the year here. I say cold. It doesn't really get cold here, but you know, when it cools down here, usually we have our first cold snap at like right after Thanksgiving, so mid to late November. But this past year, it was pretty warm all the way into December, so I didn't actually start my cooling period until like where they were fully into cooling was like January. So I had kind of a late year this year. Basically, you just gradually cool down that temp on the warm end of the enclosure until it reaches whatever the ambient temp in the room is. And I try to keep my reptile room during that time of the year at night down into the like low 60s, mid to low 60s. So
okay,
65 and below is kind of what you want to keep it at, which is kind of hard for a lot of people. But the way my herp room's set up is it's attached to my house, but I actually just close the air conditioning vents. And then on some of the nights when it maybe is a little bit too hot, I'll crack my window in the herp room and let some of that cool,
gotcha,
air into the room. And that seems to really just really help. And during the day, whatever the room temp creeps up to. Usually it's in the low 70s in the workroom during the day. So I just let it creep up, and I'll actually feed some of the Neferis during that cooling period intermittently, maybe like every other week. I'll give them like one big cricket. Maybe on the day that I water, I'll usually feed them something. And that's just kind of to help the females keep some mass on them. So when they come out of cooling, they're not too emaciated. But the reality is if you do the cooling correctly, they should be able to go the whole cooling period and come out of the cooling period and actually not have lost any weight. So that's kind of how you know that you did the cooling period right, is if your females come out of cooling and they're like, they're perfectly fine and they look exactly like they did when they went into cooling.
Right.
Yeah, they're pretty tough. I mean, in the cooling period I do is, it's like a 2-week gradual cool down. And once that gradual cool down, I incrementally lower the temps until it reaches the ambient air temp in the room. And then once they hit that point, that's when I start my time. So basically I do an 8-week cooling period. So they're in that cool period for eight weeks. And then when the cool period is over, I just gradually turn the temp back up over the course of a week. I do a little bit faster warm-up until it reaches that preferential temp, which is about 88, 89 on the warm end. And then just start feeding them a lot heavier, misting them a little bit more often. And they usually start to ovulate and are ready to breed pretty quick after that. I usually give the females about two and a half weeks, 3 weeks, depending on what they look like. If they may have lost a little weight or something during cooling, I'll give them a little bit more time to rebound that weight before I start introducing males. But that's kind of in a nutshell the cooling period. But when it comes to breeding, I pull a male and I'll usually introduce a male to a female's enclosure. I know some people do the opposite. It's usually just easier for me to just keep track of the male moving from female to female. And I do like maybe a day or 2 days at a time where the male is introduced to the female. And most of the time, what I'll do is I'll introduce the pairs. I'll turn the light off in the herp room. I'll come back in about 20 minutes and turn the light back on. And I'll go through and I'll check all the pairs that I introduced. And most of the time, they're all copulating. So, I mean, they really have a really fast, mating display. They'll actually wave their tails at each other and they'll bark sometimes and the male will grab, bite the female a whole bunch of times. Like, to somebody that doesn't know what's going on, they might think that they're fighting. It's just the beginnings of mating. So that's kind of something that's interesting. And a lot of times, some of the species that I guess are more, a little more exhibitionist is Levis levis. Usually I'll throw a male in there. They'll run right after the female. They'll start doing a breeding display and then they'll just start copulating. Wow. It'll take about 5-6 minutes usually for him to get into the proper position and then they'll start breeding. So there's some really cool behaviors, that they do during the breeding. You get to see them, wag their tails and wiggle their knobs at each other, and it's just really interesting stuff.
Have you ever decided to like use trios, like putting two females and a boy in a cage together, an option, or does it have to be pairs?
I keep all my Neferis in separate enclosures. That's just what I do. I do know of people that keep them in a harem type situation, like what leopard gecko breeders do. Only species I keep in that type of a situation is Meuli, Underwoodosaurus Meuli. And that's because in the wild, they found them in large aggregations. So they've actually found under one rock or one log, they found tons of these Meuli all together, males and females, all different sizes. And they're one of the species that tend to tolerate each other really well, where there's not a lot of interspecies aggression. Some of the other Neferis species can be a little bit aggressive toward one another, or if they tend to stress really easily when they're put together like that. So what I do is I just keep them separate. It's easier to track, what they're eating, if they're pooping properly, you know, if there's any issues, it's a little bit easier to keep track of as opposed to keeping them in a harem situation.
Right.
Not saying that that doesn't work for some people, because it does, but I really recommend keeping them separate, especially a lot of the rough species like Asper or Anii. They don't really like each other unless they're mating. You know, they're really solitary animals, and they tend to do a lot better and be a lot more healthy if they're kept separately.
Right.
If you do keep them in a large enclosure, I'd say keep them in a bigger tub than a 15-quart tub. You want to go a lot bigger than that. I'd say like a sweater box, or maybe even a little bit larger than that if you're going to keep like a trio, like a male and two females together.
Okay.
Right.
Hmm. Awesome.
And so what happens when they have eggs? Are they digging to the bottom, laying them on the bottom? What happens with the rough? Because you're keeping them drier, right? So do you set up a nest box for them, or how does that work?
Okay, so yeah, nesting kind of is pretty easy with these guys. All the rough species that don't have that cool end mound of moist sand like the smooth species
right.
do, those guys get nest boxes, and it's just basically a plastic tub with a hole cut in it, and then it's just filled with moist sand. They'll climb up in there, and they'll dig a couple nests. Usually most females will dig two or three nests before they get it right. And then once they're ready, they'll lay, and usually I'll just go in and check them if they're in the nest boxes. You know, try not to disturb them too much. And then once they're out of the nest boxes, you just kind of look at them, and you can tell if they've laid eggs or not. They're significantly skinnier. You can actually see the eggs through the abdomen on most of the species. One of the harder species to see it on is Asper. They're a little bit tricky to tell if they're gravid or not. But that's something that's nice about these guys is they're, you know, a lot of the smooth species especially, you just flip them over and look at their stomach, and you can see how far along they are in the ovulation cycle. So once they lay their eggs, they do usually lay at the very bottom of the container. So they'll dig until they hit something hard, and then they'll lay against that hard surface. They'll backfill it in, and it's pretty easy. Usually the nesting occurs 3 to 7 days after they shed. So you'll have a prelay shed, just kind of like what you do with snakes. You have a little bit of a prelay shed before they actually lay. And just with geckos, I think it's a little bit quicker. So, you know, most species, they lay 3 days after that prelay shed. So that's something to watch for if you have a female that has eggs. I just dig them up, and I incubate them in a really simplistic incubator. I try to incubate them in the low 80s. So anywhere from 80 to 82 is the temp range that I use. I use a sealed incubation container with perlite and water, and it's just a 1-to-1 ratio. Really simple. And just wipe any excess moisture off the roof of the lid, and you're good, and your eggs will hatch anywhere from 75 days to 90 days, somewhere in that range.
Jesus.
Is when the eggs hatch. Yeah. You snake guys in your short
spoils our 60-day incubations. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of these lizard species. I mean, I don't feel too bad because some of those chameleon guys. I mean, you're looking at like what Parsons is like 2 years or something like that for incubation times. Yeah.
I'd forget I had eggs.
Wow.
I would.
Yeah. Exactly.
What the hell is happening? Oh.
Put them on
right.
a shelf somewhere in the herp room and forget about them for 2 years, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
That sounds awful.
So, yeah, so 75 days is kind of a short incubation time for them. If you incubate a little bit hotter, you can get a little bit shorter incubation term. I like to keep them in the low 80s. It seems to make a little bit healthier hatchlings, in my opinion. I've incubated at the top end of the range, and the babies hatch out just fine, and, you know, there was one year where I had some eggs that I incubated around 85, 86, and I lost a few of the babies that year. So I kind of equated that to incubating at the higher temperature range. So I don't lose as many or have as many, like, problems with any type of deformities or weak hatchlings when I incubate at those lower temperatures.
Right.
If the egg broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, yeah, exactly, exactly. And there's no really – we haven't really found any temperature-dependent sex determination with these guys. So they're not like a leopard gecko where you're only going to get females if you incubate at those low temps. Usually what I end up is with a 50-50 ratio from babies that I've held back in the past, like clutch mates. Usually it's a male and a female most of the time. And sometimes it's two females, which is weird. I hardly ever get two males in a clutch.
Wow,
I think that's only happened maybe once or twice from stuff that I've held back where both of the babies were male, and it was kind of a weird clutch. It was like one egg was really small and one egg was really big, and the hatchling that hatched out of the big egg was really small, and the hatchling that hatched out of the small egg was really big. It was a weird. It was just like a really odd clutch, but they both ended up being male, and they both were healthy. I mean, they were perfectly fine. So,
weird.
Yeah, it was really, really odd clutch that time.
So when they hatch, how are you setting up the baby? Same thing as the adults, just mini? Or
yep.
Is there anything
yeah.
specific are you doing?
Yeah, no, there's no real specific thing. I say, you know, it's just like the adult care. It's just in micro version. So, I mean, smaller
gotcha.
Crickets, smaller dubia roaches. The only thing I'd say on babies, especially a lot of the thin-tailed species or the smooth thin-tailed species like Delnae, Stellatus, you want to watch their hydration and you want to make sure that they're not getting dehydrated because that can really impact their digestion. You know, I've never really had any problems with impaction with the furus, but that's because I miss them regularly. I think a lot of times when people have problems with impaction with reptiles, it's because the animals are dehydrated.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to just watch, especially with hatchlings. The other thing to point out is some species take a little bit of time to start feeding. That's nothing to be alarmed about, but if you're going past a month, you know, that's something that you need to start looking at, maybe starting to hand feed the babies. And that's very easily done. It's mostly like amniae that I've had the worst luck with and kind of the picky feeders starting off. So every once in a while, I'll get a hatchling amniae that you have to hand feed it for a little bit to get it started, or feed it crickets with the legs broken, the hind legs broken, so they're a little bit easier to catch. So those are just kind of some of the tricks that you can use. I'd say hand feeding is a last resort, just because it's really stressful for the geckos. But for instance, I had a female asper that I hatched out 2 years ago. And she did fine for a really long time, and then all of a sudden she went through this kind of bad phase where she lost a little bit of weight and kind of seemed like maybe there was something going on there. There was no parasites or anything like that, and she was completely fine other than that she just didn't feed as well. So I started hand-feeding her, and now she won't eat any other way. she's kind of a little princess. She has food given to her, and it's kind of funny because I'll pull her out and I'll have her in hand, and I'll put the cricket right up in front of her, and she'll just grab it right out of my hand. I don't have to tease her mouth open or anything like that. She's just used to eating like that now, I guess. And I'm trying to get her to eat crickets normally now because she's gravid right now. So it's kind of a pain to go in there every night and feed her crickets by hand. So, but definitely the asper are worth it. So I have to try to get her to.
Oh yeah.
To eat on their own, so.
Yeah,
cool.
That's awesome. Huh.
So, yeah, that's
there
those
any,
are the only issues that I point out with
hatchlings. That are unique to the knobtails? I mean, I've catched all kind of stuff going on with my little guy. He's, you know, a little knob will flick around. He'll throw the dust on the back of his back and, you know, all that stuff. Is there anything that you want to touch on?
You know, like behavioral-wise, they do a lot of really interesting stuff. Like what you pointed out with the wheeler eye synctus, both wheeler eye and wheeler eye synctus do that, where they'll actually kick sand onto their backs. You'll see that a lot with hatchlings. And it's just another form of camouflage, you know, just to kind of get them a little bit more broken up and not as able to be recognized by predators. And they'll sit there, and it's kind of funny, they'll kind of wiggle into the sand, and then they'll just kick a bunch of sand onto their back, and that's one cool behavior that they do. There's a whole slew of other things that are really interesting. Like the knob, for instance, we don't really know why they have the knob. There's been a lot of research done on it, and there's been a lot of things postulated, like maybe it monitors like temperature and weather, barometric pressure, things like that. And actually, we do know that it does sense vibration. That's one thing that one of the studies that has been done on the knob tail, on the actual tail itself. There's a bunch of nerves inside the knob, and then on the outside of the knob, there's a bunch of really, like, if you look at it under an electron microscope, there's actually little tiny protrusions coming off of the knob that look like hair. And they're specialized scales, and they're specialized for sensing vibration. A lot of what people think, what's postulated at least, is that they use this when they burrow down into the sand. A lot of the smooth species actually plug the entrance of their burrow with that sand. And then I've actually observed this, where the way that they lay inside the burrow, they lay with their tail facing the sand. So maybe that's kind of a anti-predatory alert system to kind of warn them if a goanna's digging them up to eat them, you know, so they can maybe burrow away or try and escape somehow. You know, so that's kind of one thing that's been postulated. Some other cool behavioral things that I've seen is I've actually seen them wiggle their knob when they see prey items. So there's even been put forward some caudal luring. So maybe they even use it as a caudal lure to lure prey items to them, to eat them. So that's another interesting thing that we don't really know 100%. That's something I'd like to study, you know, down the road. Maybe if I can convince some professor at ASU to let me do my grad work, I can study that as my graduate project. So we'll see. Yeah, that would be pretty. I think that would be pretty cool. It wouldn't be bad at all in my book. But other than the breeding behavior and, you know, feeding and breeding, there's lots of cool stuff going on there. So I'd say just whenever you go to do anything with the geckos, just kind of watch how they behave. It's kind of hard to watch them sometimes just because they're nocturnal and they don't behave normally when we're in the room. You know, I'm sure they're doing all kinds of stuff when we're out of the room. But, you know, something that you could do is put a red light over them if you really want to observe them and just try and stay really still inside the room and until they kind of forget that you're there and you can watch them that way. That's one thing about nocturnal animals is they don't see that red light. They don't pick that up at all in their visual spectrum. So kind of like they're in the dark still and you can still see them. So that's something that we're probably going to use during the feeding study when we start to really look at the, you know, feeding the arachnids and centipedes and things to them to see about what they prefer in their prey items.
Right.
Cool.
Now, one behavior that I always thought was, like, really, really, really cool is, like, the amei, right? But when they get disturbed, they kind of do that, you know, push-up thing, and they kind of, like, go on all fours as high as possible. They open their mouth. The tail goes up. It's so cool. It's so neat. They're just little badasses, you know? I love them.
Oh, yeah.
So cool.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Like, sometimes I keep everything separate, but sometimes I'll take pictures with, like, all the hatchlings from up to that point or something. And so there's all these little nephoris in the enclosure, and they're all running into each other, and they're all doing their threat displays at the same time every time they bump each other. So it's just kind of funny to see these little bitty tough geckos, you know, because they act really tough when they're doing that threat display. But yeah, you described it perfectly. They do that push up and they bark and they'll wiggle their tails and sometimes they'll even lunge and try and bite at whatever's in front of them. So yeah, they have a lot of really cool attitude in this little package. But amei, yeah, they're definitely the adults can give a little bit of a bite. I've had a few of them draw blood, so. Just caught my finger just right, you know, just enough to where they, you know, cut it open, but it wasn't anything horrible, you know, just a little bit of blood, but nothing too bad. But yeah, the defensive posture, most of them do that. There's a lot of them though that are, once they've been, you know, once they reach adult size, they're kind of laid back, kind of like carpets, like how they're a little bit bitey when they're little, and as they mature, mm-hmm. they kind of mellow out, and they're just really laid back. And it tends to be in the first, it tends to be the females that get really mellow, and they don't really care. I think it's because they get weighed the most, at least in my collection they do. I mean, I pull them out periodically and check their weights during the breeding season, so they get handled a lot more than the males. So the males tend to be a little bit more vocal, a little bit more apt to give a display, a threat display, than the females do. So yeah, my male Amy, my main male Amy, I've had him. He's one of the oldest Nephurus in my colony. He still is breeding and still doing lots of cool stuff. And he every time I have to take his weight, he tries to bite me and does his little bulldog threat display, you know, where he does his push-ups and stuff. So he's pretty consistently like that. So, but the females are just all really laid back. So.
Yeah, they're so cool. It's funny. Like the first time I heard my Noptail growl at me, I was like, "What?" Like I picked him up and I just heard this weird noise come out of him. I'm like, "Did I hurt you?" Like what? It was like, "Growl." You know, it was this growl, and I was like, "This is the most coolest animal I've ever had." Like so neat. Like, you know, they bark, they growl. They're like little dogs, man. I love it. They're so cool.
Oh yeah, definitely. They're little pit bulls or little bulldogs. You know, there's how they're kind of built, and they're just tough. You know, they're one of the toughest geckos out there. I mean, they live in some of the harshest environments on Earth. You know, it's amazing. If you really look at their tree and where they evolved from. They actually evolved from the parent lineage, just from the chameleon gecko. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the chameleon gecko, but
no.
It's Carpodactylus laevis. It's a species that's on the eastern coast of Australia, kind of up in the Queensland area, and they're just these very delicate, slender little geckos. And that's where Nephurus came from. So, I mean, that's what the parent lineage is. As far as Carpodactylae, which is the family that it belongs to. So they're in the same Nephurus fall in the same category as the Salturus geckos, which are the big, broad, leaf-tailed geckos, Phyllurus, which are also leaf-tailed geckos, and then the last one is Occultus, which is another species of leaf-tailed gecko, which are kind of, there's only one species in the whole genus. And then the Nephurus, and then the Underwoodosaurus. Those are all kind of in that family, Carpodactylidae, and they all descend from that chameleon gecko, which is just so interesting to me that that little slender, delicate gecko could evolve into all these different species that are so distinct and so well adapted to the environment that they live in.
That is very cool. I guess that also plays into their camouflage. With the, I know mossy-tailed geckos, they look almost like bark.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you look up any of the Australian leaf-tailed geckos, most of them live on, like, granite outcroppings and, like, big granite boulders and, and tree trunks and different things like that. There's a picture of one that's in the... it's in the Geckos of Australia, the Terralogue book by Hinkle.
Mm-hmm.
If you guys ever get a chance to look at that, if you flip through it, there's this picture of Salturus salabrosus, which is this leaf-tailed gecko from Australia that has this big, broad, huge tail. And it's on a granite rock with an Aboriginal handprint, where they take the pigment and they blow the pigment onto their hand and
it leaves
their handprint. The gecko's against this handprint, and it has hints of orange where the pigment from the Aboriginal artwork is. There's actually the same shade of orange in this gecko's back. So it's just it's amazing, I'm sure that artwork's been there for thousands of years. You know, it takes a long time for it to wash away, but. Yeah, I mean, that's just amazing to me. Like, if you get a chance to look at it, it's really cool.
That is awesome.
Check that out. I'll have to check that out for sure.
Yeah, but I'd say they're just as good camouflage specialists as the Madagascan leaf-tailed gecko species. You know, they don't have as much of the frills, you know, like where you see like the mossy leaf tails with these big jowls, like with the moss hanging down off of their jowls, you know, on their face, or like a Fimbriatus where their body shape has completely disappeared, you know, against the rock face. But they're just as well camouflaged as those guys are. And
that's
similar body shape too. Very similar body shape. Very similar hunting postures as well, where they'll sit face down, waiting for prey to come by, and then pounce on it from above. So I kept the Phyllurus platurus for a little while, and they're a really interesting species to keep. It's just a little bit too hot in my herp room for them usually. They like a little bit cooler tents. So.
Right.
Cool. So let's get on to some of the black-headed monitor talk.
Okay.
I'm just beginning to poke at Varanus. My friend breeds black throats and mangroves and things like that. So
cool.
Every once in a while, poking around a big lizard is always a cool thing. So can you give us a little bit of a backstory, natural history, and behind the black-headed monitor?
Yeah, sure. Black-headed monitors have actually pretty decent-sized range throughout Australia. They're mostly found in the arid portions of Australia, but there's Varanus tristis tristis, which is the nominant form, and that's the black-headed monitor. And there's a subspecies, which is Varanus tristis orientalis, which is a freckled monitor, as it's known in the trade here in the U.S. There's not a lot of difference between the two, in my opinion. I mean, if you look at them, it's hard to tell the difference sometimes. But tristis, at least in the U.S., they tend to be a little more red, a little more shades of brown. The black-headed monitors tend to be a little bit darker. But blackheads are one of the more plentiful Australian monitors, at least in more recent years, where you see them being bred a lot more often. They're not as easy to breed as you might think, though, and you know, there's only a handful of people producing those babies every year. So there's a few people that are really good at breeding monitors, and those tend to be the few people that, you know, are the ones selling those baby monitors or, you know, selling them to a wholesaler, and then you'll see them posted on Kingsnake on a wholesaler's website or, you know, different things like that. But yeah, blackheads are definitely interesting. They're found throughout Australia. They're found in a ton of different types of habitat. They're very versatile. You know, they live in tree hollows. They'll live on rock crevices, you know, and they're just like any other monitor. They eat pretty much anything that will move that they can fit down their throat. So the colony that we have is, I think we're just down to a pair now. But they're actually, they're up at Justin's place. So they're in Justin's place, which, I'm the lizard guy, but he's like a couple of lizard projects that he does, and the blackheads are one that he's been working on. But unfortunately, we just haven't had as much luck with them. We haven't had any eggs from them, and at least that we know of. Monitors are one of those animals that, you know, if you don't catch the eggs in time, the male will get in there and eat all the eggs.
Eat them, yeah.
You know,
you're a wonderful person. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Jerk.
Oh man.
But so all the blackhead monitors in the country are born in the United States. There's no possible importation from, say, Europe or any other places other than Australia?
Yeah, you know, as far as I know, there have been monitors brought in the last few years. There's been a few species, like a pretty rare monitor species from Australia, brought in through Europe. You know, there's a lot being done in Europe that's, you know, amazing. There's some amazing stuff going on over there. Like I saw some pictures from one of the ham shows, and they had some Bell's phase lace monitors. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Bell's phase lace monitors.
Yes,
but,
I am.
Yeah, there's a few people breeding them in Europe, and
get out.
And you know that means that eventually they'll make it to the U.S. With CITES the way that it is, it's very hard to import monitors in the U.S., but I don't think it's possible because there's been people that have done it in the last few years. So So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't count it out to see some Bell's Faye lace monitors in the U.S. down the road.
Wow. No, Bell's Faye are gorgeous. I just had interactions with a Cape Banded white throat monitor.
Okay.
I mean, that's another one that is just freaking gorgeous animal. And
oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah, it was great looking.
Oh, man, I kind of envy my brother. His wife is from South Africa, so he gets to go there pretty regularly, and he'll Facebook me pictures of all the stuff he finds along the road
man.
When they're going through the national park. Like, he found a giant leopard tortoise on their last trip down there, and he did a little bit of hunting and things like that. And one time they were in one of the blinds, and a black-throated monitor came into their blind and was just like cruising around in there, you know, just like, hey, you guys got some food? And eventually like chased it out of the blind. But, you know, it's just kind of cool. It's cool stuff. I mean, they're very, very social, and it's because a lot of places in the national parks, a lot of people feed them. They'll feed them scraps and stuff at the picnic areas.
Mm-hmm.
So you go to these picnic areas and you get water monitors coming up out of the, you know, like, or Nile monitors or whatever the ones that range down into that area are, and they're coming up to the picnic area wanting to eat your scraps, you know.
Oh my God.
Take food out of your hand and stuff. So, yeah, between them and the baboons will do the same thing. So you have to kind of watch your food whenever you get out of your car there.
All right, so I'm never complaining about the seagulls at the Jersey Shore again.
I don't know, man. I've been to the Jersey Shore, and those seagulls are pretty mean. They're vicious.
No, yeah, but I'd rather have that bird than, you know, giant-ass lizard or huge primate with teeth. Yeah. So,
yeah, for sure.
So do you work with any of the types of monitors over at OC Addiction, or is it just the blackheads?
We did work with Kimberly Rock monitors, but
Kimberly.
With, you know, I absolutely love them too. It was really hard for me to part with the ones that I had. I did a recent downsizing in my collection just because of how school has been and how, you know, with the threat of grad school and trying to apply for grad school, I might not be able to get into a program here where I live in Arizona, so I might have to move out of state or, you know, I was also looking at applying for maybe some zoo positions. And pretty much I'll have to go wherever I can get in. So,
yep. Been there, done that.
I might have to move. So it's just kind of one of those things that, everything's up in the air right now. So I had to sell my, anything with a heat lamp went. So it's pretty much down to Nephuris right now. And, a few odds and ends. I think I have some Lacusium, Damium, which are just, Australian beaded geckos. And then the Meli. That's kind of what I'm down to. But I had a colony of Glaurutai or Kimberly Rock monitors. By far one of my favorite monitor species to work with. Just super laid back. You know, they would take food out of your hand, but so delicately that you would never worry about them taking your finger. You know, they're just some amazing animals. One of the males I worked with quite a bit, to where I would put my hand down onto his platform that he basked on, and he would climb out onto my shoulder and sit on my shoulder while I cleaned tubs and stuff. he was a pretty cool lizard. It was hard to part with him, but
it's always one of those things you let go and you're like,
I told him to somebody that I thought was a pretty good home, so hopefully they're treating him right. So Kimberly Rocks are great. Anybody that's looking at getting any, if you want to breed them, I recommend buying a whole clutch of eggs if you can afford it. That's what I would do. Just go to a breeder or someone that you know that breeds them and say, I will buy every baby from your next clutch of eggs. So tell me how much that will cost if you're interested in breeding them. Just because I've had the worst luck with getting a sexed pair. I was buying like two hatchlings at a time or three hatchlings at a time, and I would end up with all males almost every single time.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah. So I did end up with a female eventually, but she was just never quite fed very well, and she was really weird. I'm not sure if there was something wrong with her, but she was never quite right from the beginning when I had her. So she was a little bit undersized, but I sent her to a friend of mine that lives here locally in Mesa, and he had a pair of Kimberly Rocks, and so I gave him a young pair, I didn't give them to him, but we traded some animals. Like I got some Nephurus and things in the trade, and
mm-hmm.
and he took them I think about 4 months later, he sent me pictures, and the pair was copulating. So I was just like,
oh
wow, damn it,
dang it.
So I think, wrong.
I don't think it was anything necessarily that was wrong with my husbandry. I just think maybe
right.
a change of scenery kind of
perked
an interest
just
in her.
A little
so.
Thing. Yeah, I
yeah.
know
mm-hmm.
monitor breeders who take their guys, who take their boys on car rides. Then they bring them home and put them back in the
yeah.
cage and they start breeding with female that they've yeah. been in a cage with for 2 years
yeah.
and done nothing with. Yeah, so it's like, okay.
Wow.
Monitors can sometimes be a little annoying like that.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Same with skinks, you know, it's just kind of like you have these skinks
yeah.
and you're like, are they breeding or is this female gravid? I have no idea, you know. And then one day there's
yeah.
a whole bunch of babies in the enclosure, you know, so it's.
So I guess that was happening. All right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I thought that was happening, but I wasn't sure type of thing. So.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd recommend Kimberly Rocks for anybody that's wanting to start out with monitors. They're pretty expensive, so they're not usually like an entry-level monitor species.
Okay.
Usually people start out with like Ackies, and I've kept and bred Ackies, and they're great. They're great
mm-hmm.
species to work with as well. I'd say they're a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more aggressive feeders. So they're maybe not for someone that's maybe a little bit timid when it comes to trying to handle animals.
Right.
So, you know, that's the only thing I would say, the only difference. Once you get them in hand, they're fine. But it's when you open that enclosure, Ackies are always hungry. They're always ready to eat.
Yeah.
So that they're just thinking everything is food. I actually have a pretty good size scar on my pinky finger from a very hungry female Ackie. She actually ripped the entire pad off my pinky finger was hanging by a little bit of skin, and I had to wash it out really good, and I taped it up, and it healed, and I have all the feeling in there and stuff, so it didn't do any nerve damage, but I have a pretty good size scar that runs around the base of my pinky finger and up the side where a female Ackie took a chunk out of it, so...
nice little buggers, thank you.
Oh yeah, yeah. She thought it was I was feeding them pinky mice, and she thought my pinky was a pinky mouse, I guess. So.
Wow.
Awesome. So, what would be your recommend? Those would be your recommendations for beginner monitors, Kimberly
yeah,
Rock,
I'd say,
or.
I'd say if you start with a species like red Ackies or even a yellow Ackie, you're going to see them a lot more. I'd say with black-headed monitors, they're running about the same price range, maybe a little bit cheaper black-headed monitors are, but you might end up with that empty cage syndrome where you have this beautiful cage and you don't ever see the lizard, you know, because blackheads are a little bit skittish. They tend to be a little bit more skittish. You come in the room and they're basking, they'll jump right into their hides, you know, or go down into the hollow log or whatever you might have in that enclosure. But Ackies, they don't care. They don't care if there's a marching band coming through your herp room. They'll just sit under that basking light and look at you, where's my food, you know? So Ackies,
awesome.
I think, are a little bit, maybe a little bit better option for most people starting out with monitors. I'd say, you know, start small. Start with an Ackie and get really good at keeping
mm-hmm.
Ackies and then eventually work up to those larger monitor species if that's something that you're interested in. With lizards, I think a lot of times the bigger monitors, they look really cool, and you know, you see one that's really tame, somebody's walking it on a leash at the herp show, but they really require a lot of space and a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
Monitors are not something to just lightly take on. They require a lot of heat, a lot of food if you're going to breed them, you know, high temps, high heat, you know, lots of light, and lots of food, and they're very expensive to do right.
Right.
You know, if you're breeding your own rodents, that will help a ton, but I guarantee you if you have a few pair of monitors, your electric bill is going to go up too.
Yeah, definitely. So, and it's a good thing, I guess, another added point would be most of the Yakis you're going to get are going to be captive bred and born, where most of the time I see people starting out with wild-caught savannah monitor that, you know.
Farm-raised, farm-hatched.
Yeah, you see that stuff dying.
Yeah, there's a lot more you can pick. That's kind of the thing that's a little bit sad for me, especially with the tree monitors. You go to the herp shows and you see these emaciated tree monitors, and
on the people's tables,
you know, they're freshly imported, or you know, they probably looked a little bit better when they were, you know, freshly imported than what they look like now. But you know, and it's really kind of one of those things. Like I'm glad to see a real big resurgence in people trying to reproduce the tree monitor species. It seems like they're getting a big following now, and it seems like there's a lot of people trying to work with them. So hopefully that will help to kind of reduce the pressure on wild populations, because those guys aren't really farm bred. Like you said, like your savannas or your black throats, or even some of your Niles or water monitors, those guys are farm bred usually when you see a little baby hatchling in the 10-gallon aquarium squirming around. That guy was bred on a farm somewhere in Africa and then, you know, exported to the U.S. Where, you know, the tree monitors are adults usually. Usually they don't have juvies or hatchlings. So,
and, you know, by farm, it's basically just a big pen outside.
Exactly. So, yeah, that's just kind of, I guess, my two cents Anytime you buy any type of reptile, you want to get captive bred. And I'd say 99.9% of the time that you're buying an Australian reptile, it's going to be captive bred. You know, the laws as strict as they are within Australia, any of those animals that are there hasn't been any real legal export outside of zoos or scientific purposes. You know, other than that, those have been the real legal channels of export of animals coming out of Australia since the 70s, since that ban was initially put on the animals. And, you know, Australia does a pretty good job of protecting its native wildlife, but some of the stuff they do kind of is frustrating, too, where they'll find a species of gecko or a skink, and they'll protect it. You can't catch these skinks. You can't keep them in captivity, but then they'll sell the mining rights of that skink habitat to a mine, you know, and it's like, what are you doing? You know, there's an endangered
species. So how are we supposed to save it when you just did this?
And then they won't let the people that live in Australia go and collect the skink and breed it in captivity, you know. So it's just kind of frustrating.
Right.
We do the same thing in the U.S. I mean, we do the same stuff.
This is true.
It's just a never-ending cycle of annoying decisions on the part of our our Congress or whoever's making the laws.
Whoever's in charge,
that's just kind of frustrating.
If Australia just would let something, like a quota out every year, there wouldn't be people trying to smuggle things. There wouldn't be people, if they would, like, shinglebacks, everybody wants one. Think about it. They get hit by cars in Australia, all the time. People find them, and I would kill to have one, yet I can't because, you know what I mean? Like, just take 20 of them a year. 20 of them a year to go into America. It would feed us our hunger for them.
We talk about this all the time. I mean, Justin goes to Australia. I mean, he's been able to go the last 3 years, and he's going to go this year again, or this will be his third year in a row that he gets to go. And he's going there to speak at the Scales and Tails Expo in Ipswich. So, I mean, with the release of the Amateurasia book that he just finished, him and Nick Mutton, and then the Australian author, Peter Birch, he'll be at the expo as well. So that's a really cool opportunity for him. But I mean, we get put under such heavy scrutiny. I mean, we're Australian addiction reptiles, and we get, you know, Justin gets searched at the airport when he leaves, and it's like we don't ever do anything illegal. I mean, everything that we keep and breed has been captive bred. You know, no one's ever tried to take anything from the wild other than pictures of things, you know? So, I mean, that's
right.
That's the only thing. And that's what's frustrating about the whole, I guess, laws and, you know, going over there and coming back. And I don't know if they'll ever allow export out of Australia again, but I hope that they do. You know, with their captive bred reptile market there, it's growing. It's like comparable to what it was in the early 90s is what they're going through right now in Australia. And they're catching up to us with morphs. I mean, you guys see all the carpet morphs that are coming out.
Mm-hmm.
They have the trees.
Yes.
But they have, I mean, they have some killer stuff there. And, you know, even just locality-specific things like the Goldfield shingleback, for instance. I mean, look at that. I mean, that thing is amazing. And it's just it's just a locality-specific animal. So, I mean, there's some amazing stuff in Australia, and I think they should protect their wildlife. But at the same time, I think that there is a market there that if they were to tap into, they could tax it, and people would pay top dollar for those animals.
Oh, yeah.
I know personally I would shell out thousands of dollars for animals directly from Australia to strengthen my bloodlines. You know, that would be amazing if the Australian government would do that, would allow a quota of, X amount of captive bred offspring. You know, we're going to let this much out every year, you know.
Yeah.
And then they could tax the crap out of it, you know. They could make money off of it. So,
right,
I mean,
so
that's what all politicians really care about anyway, right?
So we'd all be getting bank loans at the same time.
Yeah.
So which one of us is going to go to Parliament and knock on their door?
I got it. What was that?
Get me on
which
point.
Which one of us is going to go to Parliament over there in Australia?
Oh, yeah,
and
to the Australian Parliament.
Come on
that.
Now. Please.
I'll do it.
I'll beg them.
I'll do it. I'll wear the robes and the powdered wig and all that fun stuff. It'll be great. I can't
wait.
I'm
over there.
I don't know if they still do that. Do they still do that?
I think they do.
Yeah.
I thought they did.
Oh, okay.
Because they're a colony of England, or they used to be. So
yeah.
I imagine they still would. But if I do go, Eric has to come get me from an Australian prison after, you know, whatever's going to transpire over there transpires, and I am surely arrested. So I'm just going to say it. If I'm caught at the airport trying to take rough scales back with me, it's just bound to happen.
Oh, you don't need rough scales. There's rough scales in the U.S.
But I want them now. And I don't want to pay the money that they got them for now.
Just be patient. That's one species that I'm, one species of legless animal that I'm definitely going to own someday is a pair of rough scales. I'm just amazed that they're available in the hobby. I never in a million years thought that I would see captive bred rough scale pythons in the United States.
Apparently they breed like rabbits. Apparently if you go to an expo over in Australia, they're like, thank you for coming. Here's a pair of rough scale pythons.
Yeah.
It's like,
everybody's got a pair of roughies in Australia, I guess. I mean, they're a dime a dozen over there. So, but I remember seeing that. You guys remember O'Shea's Big Adventure, the old Mark O'Shea TV show on Animal Planet?
Yes.
Remember that episode where he went and they were looking for rough scale pythons, and then at the last second, the guy comes over with the bag and shows them the rough scale python. Oh man, that was such a cool episode.
Awesome.
I remember watching that as a kid.
Dude, Justin was holding on to a hair for somebody, wasn't he?
What was that?
Justin was holding onto a pair of rough scales for somebody a little bit ago.
Yeah,
wasn't he? Did you get to see him when he had them?
If you look at my Facebook picture, I'm actually holding, I think it's the male in that picture. That's my Facebook picture. I have a Carinata in my hand. So they're really, really cool snakes. I mean, they're just, like, once you get them out of the enclosure and start handling, they're just super placid, just laid back, you know. They have that blue, steel blue eyes, you know. I mean, they're just amazing. And then the color change that they go through at night, and I mean, they're really, really cool snakes. So someday I will have a pair of rough scale pythons. So
you and me both.
Definitely. This right now at ASU, I'm actually working with snakes. I work in a laboratory there as an undergraduate, and we're working with a big colony of children's pythons. So that's what I do in between classes. Is I go and work in the lab, and we've hatched out some children's pythons, and we're using them for some different breeding studies and behavioral studies there at ASU and in that lab. So that's kind of cool. So I do a little bit of Python stuff, but not too much. I think this year will be the first year I'll have some pythons, and I'm getting a pair of pygmy pythons from Justin. So that'll be the first pythons I've had in probably 4 years, 5 years. 5 years, yeah. So that'll be fun for me, I guess. So
cool.
But eventually the carionauta are on my list for sure.
Everyone loves the carionauta except for Zach. He's stuck up with chondros.
I never said that. Well, nah, come on now.
I don't know. Chondros are awesome. They're coming with some really cool morphs. I mean, there's some cool stuff coming with chondros.
That is true. Okay. I'm terrified of it.
And they are related to carionauta. I mean,
they are. They're like
they're their evil
form
of. They're their closest relative.
Yeah.
They're like desert.
Carionata
is
like armor-plated chondro.
Exactly. They're like desert edition of a chondro.
Exactly.
Chondro, so.
But I'm too terrified to keep chondros, so.
Yeah.
They're the easiest snake
braver.
I've ever kept, dude.
They do have that stigma to them, don't they?
They do. And I guess it's hard
to
do. It's going to take somebody like Buddy Buscemi beating me up about buying a chondro to finally, like, get one and then realize that I've just been a chicken shit all these years. And, you know, then I get, like, four. But until then, no. No, I'm just going to avoid this.
Yeah. I really like the chondros with, like, high amounts of yellow speckling. And, there's some really, really beautiful chondros out there. And I don't know. Maybe if I don't live somewhere so dry down the road, I might look into keeping some. But, you know, there's only so much space and so much money and so much time. So, I'm, you know, primarily a lizard guy, and that's where most of my interest lies. My main goal right now is knocking out the whole Nephrurus genus. So I'm pretty close to that. I think I lack three species, or this next year I'll lack three species. So, the species I lack are somewhat attainable. The only one that's really hard to find, that's going to be hard to find, is Shea-Eye. But I do know there are some in Europe, so that will be, eventually they'll trickle into the U.S. I don't think I want to pay the amount that they're asking for in Europe right now. I think they're like 10 or 12 grand a pair or something like that.
Oh, sweet Jesus.
Yeah. And they look a lot like Amii. I mean, they're very similar coloring to Amii. There are some really cool locality-specific Shea-Eye. Like the one that comes from the Mitchell Plateau is kind of banded and kind of different colored. But other than that, they look a lot like Amii. It's not like Asper where it's like black, you know, where they're these black Amii or these bright white with dark reticulations like some of the Asper. But, Shea-Eye is pretty, pretty close to what an Amii looks like. So just a little bit smaller, and they have more toe banding around the toes. They have these kind of light-colored rings around their toes. That's the main difference. Yeah, they're not really that different.
Do you think
cool.
we'll ever get the banded asper here in the state?
I would love to have some banded asper. You know how it is. Some stuff just trickles into the U.S., into Europe eventually. I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't doubt that they make it to the U.S. eventually. I mean, look at Australia. They have jags. You know, they have zebras and things that were bred over here. You know,
funny how they got there. Yeah.
Oh yeah, how'd they get there? Who knows? You know, they have ball
Maybe
pythons
they
and leopard geckos and stuff. You know, those are some people keep what they call exotics, and they're like really excited about these exotics. And it's like, well, I see a million ball pythons every herp show I go to, and it's. I kind of get tired of looking at ball pythons, and to them it's just this foreign, cool thing. But, you know, those are, of course, illegal to keep there. You know, how'd they get there? They have albino levis over there as well, and from what I've heard is they descend from the albino levis pilferensis that we have here in the U.S. So I don't know how true that is. There could have been somebody that hatched out a lettuce over there that was albino, but I wouldn't doubt that that's what happened. You know, who knows?
Funny things, how these things happen, how it's like the borders are shut, but not so much.
Exactly. So to answer your question about the banded Asperger's, I hope so. I hope that eventually there are some banded Asperger here.
Yeah, I've
that
seen
would be
very
cool.
I'll be the first one on the waiting list as soon as I find out about them. So.
As soon as you produce them, let me know, because, oh, man.
Oh, yeah.
They do it for me, man. Awesome animals.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you know, anybody out there listening, if you've never seen a banded Asper, look that up. Just type in banded Asper into Google Images, banded Nephrus Asper, and they're amazing. Very, very beautiful gecko. Just a really lot of contrast, and just really, really pretty, pretty geckos. But the banded form, that comes from far northern Queensland, and there's different variations. There's darker ones with light bands. There's ones with dark bands. There's ones that have almost kind of a purple color in their banding, you know, just from some of the pictures I've seen. That's one that I'd really like to see out in the wild, and kind of look for a few different populations and see kind of the differences and how they look. And so, yeah, I'd love to own some banded Asper someday.
That would
be
very, very cool.
One day. Yeah, we're kind of we're running low on time, but
yes, we are.
I will kick myself in the head if I didn't ask you some skink questions, because you know I'm obsessed.
You have 2 minutes worth of skink. Go.
No, I can't.
Yes.
I can't put it in 2 minutes. Sorry, you'll be fine. So, do you still work with Depressa at all?
You know what? That's actually one of the things that had a heat lamp on it. So, I did send those off. So, I really struggled with parting with the Depressa, but they went to a really good home. So, I sent them over to a buddy of mine that has a bunch of Depressa. So, they're going to get bred, and you'll see some babies out of them eventually. I'm pretty sure she was gravid when I sent her off as well. So, hopefully she ends up having a baby for him, because I would definitely like to see that I was fruitful. You know, at least I got them to breed. Right. They were really, really interesting to me, but the female was really, like, she would come out and she would bask. And for those of you who haven't seen our website, we actually had the red form of Depressa, which is it's now classified as Agurnia signitos. They did a recent taxonomic revision on them. And so the Depressa complex. Taxonomic revisions again. But they took the Depressa complex, which is several different locality variations. There's kind of an orange form, and then there's two different gray forms, and then there's the red form that comes from the Pilbara, and that's the one that we had. The red form is the rarest, and they're the lowest producing. They usually only have one baby, and they only have one baby every other year. So they're pretty hard to reproduce. But really cool social dynamics. I mean, you can leave the babies in with the adults, and they'll live in a little family group. I mean, and you go in the find them in the wild, and there's a dominant male, several females, and then several offspring from previous seasons, and even males and females. And usually what will happen if the male starts to become a little bit more older to breed, they drive that male out of the colony. So he has to go find some other place to spread his genes. But, they live in these family groups. And you'll see that a lot with Agurnia, where they're in these loose family groupings. That's something that's being studied right now a lot more in depth, is the social dynamics that exist in skink species. And I'm sure most of you guys are familiar with the pair bonding in shingleback skinks, where they'll actually go and they'll seek out that mate every single year. And they're seeing that a lot more with skinks, that they're, you know, they pair bond. So that's really cool, especially for someone like me that studies animal behavior. It's really interesting and something that eventually I would really like to look into studying down the road.
Yeah. I know the prehensile tail skinks do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They have a colony at the Philadelphia Zoo down here.
Uh-huh.
And was fortunate enough in my herpetology class in college to go and poke around back there with the keepers.
So, oh, man.
Nice. They're definitely
nice.
Cool. Yeah. Nah, 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 Zach.
Oh my God, you're killing me, man. You know, I think we're pretty cheesy ever. Oh my God.
I'll kill you a little bit more, Zach. I got to go backstage at the San Diego Zoo a couple years ago, and they have a pretty good colony of prehensile tail skinks there as well. So that was pretty cool to see too. I mean, you know, that's just something fairly recently too that they found out that they have that type of social structure.
Almost
feel bad, you know, with how much they were imported years back, that, you know, you had these air bonds and people were just picking the ones that they thought were prettier and leaving all the drab ones, and you probably broke up a whole bunch of family groupings,
So the other problem is that no one
sad.
Paid attention to the islands, because
they
would grab a pretty one from this box and a pretty one from this box, and you find that those are two skinks from two different islands. They're like, why aren't they getting along? It's like, well, duh.
Yep.
So
they're like different tribes and such. Yeah, like, because it's there really are. I could go on for another hour about those, so I'm not gonna get into them.
Doesn't Tom Crutchfield have some for sale, Zach? You should need like what, like
$10,000
or something like that.
Yeah, something like
you really
that.
You want to end up on a whiteboard?
What a great collection. Isn't it like 3.3 or something? Oh,
yeah, it's like 3.3, I think, something like that.
I'd be freaking
I saw those the other day, and I thought of you. I was like, oh, it's Mr. Zach.
Oh, Zach,
see, but
if you could only sell his car and sell his collection, maybe you could get some.
We would all sell our cars, right, if we didn't have a, you know.
If we didn't need for a car,
like in my case, but if I didn't have a wife and kids, that you know, I'd probably be living in some trailer that's completely full of reptiles with a bike.
Hell yes. There we go. So, anyways, we are recording now. We are off live. So, Steve, why don't you hit us up with your website information, how people can get in contact with you about buying some geckos or figuring out your projects for the next coming year.
Yeah, no problem. So the website is just australianaddiction.com. And, you know, we have on the website itself, there's a section that says about us. If you click on that, it has all my contact information on there. And I'm the lizard specialist. I do pretty much all the nephritis. And, you know, Justin's working with the Sunshine Blue Tongue Skinks now. Those are up at his place. And then also the black-headed monitors. You know, other than that, any other lizard project that we have listed on our website is at my place. So if you're interested in any of the species you see on the website, feel free to shoot me an email. My email is aarsal@gmail.com. I'm more than happy to answer any questions. If anybody has any questions about care, breeding, I'm always happy to answer questions. It might take me a little bit of time sometimes to respond to all the emails, but even if you haven't purchased animals from me, I don't mind. I don't mind helping people out and getting them started out on the right foot with nephritis or monitors or skinks or anything in general. I just love to talk herps, and so feel free to contact me. Some of the upcoming projects will have plenty of levis, amii, neeli, wheeleri. And then possibly we may have some asper as well late in the season, depending on how many clutches I get out of the phenom. So, feel free to – oh, and Delmi. We should have plenty of Delmi as well this year. So feel free to email me with any questions or, you know, I don't really have a waiting list, but if you email me and tell me you're interested in a species, I will hold on to your email and contact you when I have something available.
Awesome. Well, all right, Steve, thanks for coming on. We'll have to bring you back on so we can get some more skink talk, and we'll have to bring Zach back, too, because he'll be the one who really wants it. So.
Yes. sounds good, guys. Thanks for having me on. I had a lot of fun.
All right, thanks a lot, Steve.
Thank you.
Have a good night, all right?
All right, you too, guys. Bye.
All right, guys.
Bye. Zach, you've done well.
Did I do good?
You did good. I think I'm going to replace you with Eric, Eric, you don't need to do this anymore. And I know you're listening, Eric, because we're still on the air and I have no power of what's going on. So I know you're there. I know you are.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes.
Oh, man, he sounds worse.
Yeah,
I mean,
yes. That was a 50-50 shot. He was still alive. So
Night crew, man, just knocked out.
That was a cool show, guys. A lot of info there, man.
So now you want some knockouts? Because I know I do. They're kind of cool.
Nah, yeah. Like I told you before, I'm a snake guy, man.
If it's got legs, you don't want it. Gotcha.
I dig them. I really like them. I think they're fascinating, but they're for me to enjoy in somebody else's collection type of thing.
Right. I got you.
You know what I mean?
I got you. Let that Mike Gecko person start doing knob tails then. And you enjoy crusties and knobs, but only when they're at shows. Hey, Cahoodle. Eric, why don't you do the rundown so you get the hell out of here?
Yeah, really, man.
Oh, man, you want me to do it? Okay.
I can do it if you want me to. I've never done it before, so let's try it. I'll do it.
Yeah, go
for
it.
So we were sponsored by MoreliaPythons.com. It's the best forum for Morelia out there on the Internet. We are all free members of that site, and it's the only place to go to get in-depth information on all types of Morelia, as well as other species of python that you might have questions about. Definitely check it out. It is the place to go. You can also enjoy Rogue-Reptiles on Facebook.com, as well as EB Morelia and the Morelia Pick of the Week on Facebook.com. You can just enjoy lots of Morelia on Facebook. Tons of stuff. If you're like me, your entire Facebook feed should just be nothing but freaking pythons. And you can also enjoy Dark Side Exotics, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, Dark Side Exotics.
That's another page on Facebook.
Yes.
Good. Second.
Go ahead.
Okay, you go ahead. You plug away your own company. You good? Do it.
Okay. All right. Dark Side Exotics. I got two clutches hatching out in the next, I don't know, 2 weeks now? So my first is my coastal clutch, coastal to tiger jag. So that's going to be good. And then I have my striped jungles hatching out in a couple weeks. That'll be good. I'm also putting a lot of breeders up for sale and such in the next couple weeks. So keep an eye out for that. And if you need to contact me, ZachFaez@yahoo.com. Pretty easy. You can contact me through there or Facebook. I'm always around. A little bit of a Facebook junkie, so I'm always on there. That's it.
That's good. All right. And then also upcoming events, we have the Arboreal Symposium down in Maryland. I'm going to be there. Eric's going to be there. Zach, are you coming?
You think I'm going to miss that? Dude,
That's a good answer. Come down. It's going to be, I think, one of the best reptile experiences that we've ever had. If you buy a ticket, it's going to be a three-day show. It's not just a bunch of people standing around selling snakes. There's also going to be lectures from some of the best minds in the reptile world on different species of arboreal reptiles. Also, they're going to feed you. You're going to get either ribs or crab cakes, or you're going to be like me, and you're going to order the ribs, and you're going to push Zach and take his crab cakes, and you're going to have both. So it's going to be
good luck,
awesome. Yes, I cannot wait. If you come, you can hang out at the tables. I'm going to be bringing some of my very, very cool stuff to show off. I'm talking the carpet pythons, the super caramels will make their debut at that show, I've already decided. Also, I'm going to be bringing some of our black phase white lips, and some of our Wilhelmina and very rare scrubs. What?
I'm excited about all the interesting pythons you're going to bring, man. I just want to see those things.
Some people haven't seen a black face white lip up close and personal.
I've never had.
I got several, so I'm going to bring them just so you can check it out. Because,
Dude,
those are the snakes that got me hooked, so check it out.
Those things are
you're stealing. While you're stealing Zach's crab cake, I'm going to be stealing your white lip python.
You son of a bitch. You bring
alive?
It back because you're like, it's mean. So,
oh, man.
Anyways, that'll be that. So, I think that's everything, right? Did I miss anything?
I think that's everything.
All right, cool.
Go get some sleep, Eric. God.
Yeah. Let's move on. I'm going to stop asking him questions. Anyway, that's over. We'd like to thank Zach Bias for coming on and filling in for Eric, even and
no
Eric's
problem.
Dying. So it's always mm-hmm. good with that. What we'll say is for everybody else who's still listening or downloaded at this point, thank you for listening, and we will catch you all next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.